David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 197 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crowe, that's Crowe with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. There's an important court case in my neck of the woods, Calgary in Canada, a health-related court case. And we have David Steffen, who's been through his own court case and also has been on the show for two episodes before, to give us an update. It's a long interview, so let's get right to it. David Steffen was our guest in episodes 126 and 127, discussing the death of his son Ezekiel in 2012. And again, our condolences for that tragedy. As you may remember, David and his wife were convicted of failing to provide the necessities of life, but appealed, and we'll get an update of that case 6 years later. Now there is a similar case, also on trial in Calgary, Canada, the Clark case. David has been following that case, giving Facebook live streams, and he will give us an update from a different perspective than you're going to get in the mainstream media. I'll put David's Facebook page, which has the live streamed video from outside the courthouse, in the show notes. It is facebook.com/david.steffen.568. And because it's in the show notes, you don't need to worry about the spelling. Welcome back to the show, David.
Thank you so much for having me on, David. I appreciate you covering the other side of the story here.
Yes. We were talking earlier, and I got a lot out of your Facebook live streams because you know a lot about what's going on in the courtroom and also a lot of the technical details. But hopefully in this back and forth, we can get a pretty good summary of what's going on. And it is now, we're taping this on Monday, October 15th, and there have been updates on Monday, October 15th. So this is about as close to live news as I'm ever going to do on the show. So John Wyatt Clark was 14 months old on November the 28th, 2013. He was still being breastfed when he was taken to the hospital, and he died less than a day later at the hospital. And his parents, Jeremy and Jennifer Clark, are on trial for his death. So can you first describe the sequence of events from that happened leading up to his death?
Absolutely. Yeah, so I'll speak chronologically from what we've received within the courtroom. Mm-hmm. And so, obviously, there was a police investigation that took place into this, and it was a little bit beyond what we'd typically expect to see with these types of charges. But through that police investigation, they went and they raided the house, and they raided the computers and looked at what the Google searches were, you know, had a forensic digital expert come in and do all that type of stuff. And so if we're talking about it chronologically, what we see is that on November 13th of 2013, yeah, is that there was a Google search for poor circulation in the foot of an infant. And so that would lead one to believe that likely the Clarks had something of concern at that point in regard to the circulation of John Wyatt Clark's foot. We're going to assume that the search was made in regard to him, right. Especially given, you know, where it led. Mm-hmm. But there was no searches thereafter until 6:21 on November 27th. So 2 weeks later, there appears to be a concern that rises up again wherein they do a search. And this time the search is on gangrene. And so This is the evening of November 27th. And so this fits in line with the story that's come out in court, wherein they began to see black edging on his toes or toe. Not sure exactly what point that was, but it was likely on November 27th. And at about this point, he's still breastfeeding and he's eating some solids, but he's starting to lose some interest in feeding. He's not really feeling the best. He's been sick for a few days. And so the parents start to look into it a little further, and there seems to be something going on with him. He's becoming a little bit lethargic, and on the 28th, he starts to become cold. So They give him a warm bath, and they recognize at the end of the bath is that his his toes, the edging of his toes was starting to get a little worse.
Right.
So they take him into the Foothills Hospital, and he arrives there at about 3:20 on the 28th, and the initial doctor,
3:20 p.m., just because it's a very short timeline, there's a big difference. It's important, right?
Absolutely, yes. Thank you very much for clarifying that. So it's now afternoon. They bring him into the hospital, and he's definitely in need of care. He's now hypothermic when he arrives. Mm-hmm. He's got a temperature of about 30 degrees Celsius. He's presenting with a little bit of lethargy, and he's presenting with a body rash. Now, the body rash was something that was typical to him. It was a chronic condition that the parents were treating as eczema, and every doctor that saw him identified it as such, as just eczema. So it wasn't really part of the equation, or at least it didn't seem to be. So
quote from the CBC? So you can just comment on what the CBC wrote. And this is a direct quote from an article that I think was earlier in October. When the family arrived at hospital, John was in septic shock, hypothermic, had a blistering rash covering more than 70% of his body, and four toes were black with gangrene. So how accurate is that statement?
Well, it's somewhat accurate, but largely inflated. So if we break it down, the very first point was?
Septic shock.
Okay. So now there were some doctors that had said that he was in septic shock, but that goes against what the actual reporting was or what they recorded 5 years ago. And so anybody sitting in the courtroom had to kind of parse through what people were recalling from memory versus what they had actually documented in the medical notes. And so septic shock was not really anything that was brought forward. In fact, it was quite the opposite, wherein the first triage nurse that saw him said he was alert and crying. When he arrived to Alberta Children's Hospital, the first trauma bay emergency doctor noted that he was alert, crying, that he was looking around, and that he was interacting with his surroundings. And then another nurse did a Glasgow coma score or scale rating with him, and he got 15 out of 15, showing that he was neurologically there. So the septic shock actually doesn't hold up. And today we heard even more evidence that it was not the case. There was no scientific basis for it. And we'll get to that in a bit. So the septic shock wasn't there.
Okay, so hypothermic.
That is legit. So, that's something that can't be debated. They brought in at one point, reads at 29.7. Another reading shortly after is 30 degrees. So he's hovering around that 30-degree mark, which is about 6.5 degrees lower than it ought to be given the circumstances.
Right, so that's pretty serious. The third thing was a blistering rash covering more than 70% of his body.
Yes. Now, if we take a look back at a day or two previous, CBC was reporting that it wasn't a blistering rash covering 70% of his body, but it was actually an infectious rash. So the story continues to change as time goes on with CBC's reporting there. But the blistering rash is an inaccurate depiction as well. And the reason for that is that there was, what that would lead you to believe is when you think of infectious rash and they say, that it's weeping and all that stuff, is that, he's covered and he just looks like grotesque. And then the same thing with blistering, something similar that you'd get if you had a major case of meningitis to the point where it goes septic and you break out in the rash.
Right.
That's not at all what the case was. Every doctor that saw him reported that, it just looks like eczema and there's some crusting, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there may have been a blister or there may have been a slightly open portion, but it was nothing of concern to any of the doctors. It actually wasn't until 3 days after John Wyatt Clark had died that it was brought into question as to what it actually was by the medical examiner, who identified it as just eczema until she wanted to look further into it and was utilizing that to try to establish that it was due to malnourishment was what all of his condition was due to. And so she was trying to utilize this rash as a confirmation that he was malnourished. But every doctor previous to that made no concern over it, no notes on it in regard to blistering or being infectious. So it's really just an inflated part of the story that makes you really have some resentment towards these parents, because how dare they leave their child in this condition to the point where he's covered with 70% of his body in this grotesque rash.
Yes. Finally, they said four toes were black with gangrene.
Yes, and that's incorrect. So one of the reports about him initially coming in says two toes, but most of the reports upon initial arrival were two toes, the second and third toe on his right foot, and I believe it was the third toe on his left foot. So three toes were beginning to get some black edging. And so, yeah, it's a poor depiction of, you know, you envision that these toes have gone completely black when it's the edges of them are starting to turn black.
Right, right. I mean, I would interpret four toes were black as four toes were 100% black or close to 100% black. You had actually, as we were talking earlier, you'd brought up, you know, an interesting situation that can occur with some children, which I had never heard of before, which is a hair tourniquet. So could you describe what that would be? Not as it's necessarily in this case, but it's interesting because it could easily happen to anybody.
Absolutely. And it shows what was concerning the nurses and the doctors upon initial presentation to the hospital. So the very first nurse that triaged John Wyatt Clark at the Foothills Hospital noted that there was a severe impairment in his circulation that was causing this phenomenon. So it was apparent that it wasn't just exclusive to the toes, but it was actually, you know, going back to that November 13th search that there's something going on with the circulation to the foot that's causing this phenomenon. And so the first doctor at the Foothills Hospital actually checks to see if there's a hair tourniquet, which is, you know, it can happen. I know when we're putting, or my wife brought it up with me, you know, putting socks on the children, but rather than just a nighty, because, you know, one of the threads in the nighty can wrap around a toe or something, cut off the circulation. It doesn't even have to be that tight or that incredibly uncomfortable. And sure enough, you know, you can end up with a dead appendage. So the doctor actually checked to see if there was a hair that had been wrapped around one of his toes or all of his toes or somewhere just
right
up the line that was causing that that necrosis, the dying of that tissue.
And I think with something like that, you could easily see that it could happen to any parent. And you might wake up in the morning and one of your child's toes, or maybe two, are, obviously in serious trouble. But it's an interesting way where you could get a circulation problem without the media has kind of been portraying the idea that these were negligent parents.
Absolutely, yeah. So that's how he presented. Do you want me to continue on chronologically?
Yeah, if you could keep on. Because we were at the Foothills Hospital, which is an adult treatment hospital, basically. And he was transferred to the Butter Children's Hospital. So maybe you can explain why that happened.
Yeah, for a couple of reasons. One, weren't able to achieve an IV at the Foothills Hospital. The second thing is that they placed the intraosseous line, which is the alternative to an IV where they drill directly into the bone and inject fluids that way. They placed it poorly, and so when they went and began to inject fluids, it actually popped out, which is not a good thing. And then they were also, it appears that they were lacking equipment to a certain degree because they weren't able to even take his blood pressure at that point. I believe it was a blood pressure because they didn't have the cuff or an infant cuff. So they ended up calling an ambulance. Ambulance comes by or was already there. They pick up John 3 minutes later. They're over to Alberta Children's Hospital. They arrive at the trauma bay at the Alberta Children's Hospital at 3:51 p.m. on November 28th. He's admitted into the trauma bay where they begin the initial therapies or treatments, medical treatments, and then he's going to be admitted into the ICU. And so that's where they did, you know, there's assessments made of him again. The first trauma bay doctor identifies that, you know, he's fully neurologically well and he's not in seizure. He's not having a cardiac arrest. Mm-hmm. The main issues at hand is that they identify he has hyponatremia, which is low sodium, which can cause neurological issues. And in fact, it can actually create the hypothermia and the lethargy that he was having. So they identified that he's got hyponatremia that needs to be treated and that he has obviously the hypothermia and that he's he's got the Glasgow Coma Scale rating at 15 out of 15, but that he's definitely in need of care.
Right.
So
right.
What they do is by 4:05, so now we're talking 14 minutes into him being at Alberta Children's Hospital, they're able to properly place an intraosseous line. And so now they're going to begin injecting fluids into him. And so what they did is they began with an aggressive, and this is the words of the doctors, an aggressive saline resuscitation.
Mm-hmm.
And so what that is where they act very, very quickly to try to bring the sodium levels up to the normal range. And what the normal range is 135 to 145 millimoles per liter of saline concentration.
And for people who aren't very up on their chemistry, salt is sodium chloride.
Right.
So saline solution is salt, and that contains the sodium that you need to bring up the sodium levels.
That is correct, yes. So they're going to introduce a saline solution, which is normally about a 0.9 concentration is your typical saline solution. But he's fairly low. Now, the problem is with hyponatremia is you need to, one, assess it properly and then address it properly. And so the assessment would identify whether or not it's acute hyponatremia, which has taken place very rapidly, and the body has, or the brain hasn't had the ability to adjust to it yet. So then you're presenting with serious neurological conditions. Or if it's chronic hyponatremia, it's something that's taken place over time and the brain has adjusted to those low sodium levels. And so both of them are going to require different treatment. In acute, you can bring up the sodium levels much quicker than with chronic. And the reason why is because the brain hasn't adjusted yet, so you can re-bring up those sodium levels without creating major iatrogenic brain damage. So that assessment wasn't done. And so they just went right forward with it, treating him as if he had acute hyponatremia and that it needed to be dealt with rapidly. But even at that, they still went over five times the safe rate of raising his sodium levels if he were actually in acute hyponatremia.
Right.
If he was in chronic hyponatremia, which is actually how his symptoms were presenting, it was over 70 times too quickly. And what this causes is the demyelination of the nerve cells within the brain, and you end up with this major die-off of these cells and in the pons area of the brainstem. So it's called osmotic demyelination syndrome. And
right.
So you end up with the axonal severing. It induces the apoptosis of the cells, which is the programmed cell die-off.
Right.
And so basically you've got your brainstem, which is controlling the flow of all information from the brain to the body, and it's being severely impaired. And now everything is going to go haywire, especially the vitals, being your blood pressure, your heart rate, your breathing rate. Everything is now going to be destabilized because the brainstem controls those functions. And so, and generally people will die from osmotic demyelination syndrome. And so that's what ended up occurring, or appears to occur. All the symptoms are there, and that was confirmed actually today by the former chief medical examiner of Alberta, where she identified that was in fact the case, that by getting way too much saline, that he ended up in this condition. So 4:05, they begin the process.
Right.
At 4:17, they do another blood gas rating, and they see that it's gone from 108 up to 115, which is 7 millimoles per liter increase. Now,
right.
Just to give you an idea here, if it's chronic hyponatremia, you do not increase more than 0.5 millimoles per liter per hour. And they already, within 12 minutes, increased it up to 7 millimoles.
So that's 14 hours worth of increase in 15 minutes.
Exactly. In 12 minutes. Exactly.
Yeah.
And then it only got worse from there. We'll get into that in a minute. Or if it's acute hyponatremia, you can only increase up to 4 to 6 millimoles per liter for the first hour. And then you still have to take it easy and max out at about that 10 to 12 millimoles per liter within a 24-hour period. So they still went above and beyond within 12 minutes what the highest recommended rate was for treating acute hyponatremia. So either way you slice it, it was well above and beyond the safe limits of what should ever be applied, and you'd expect survival from it. So So that's at 4:15, they do the blood gas reading, or 4:17. And at 4:18, they give him another bolus of sodium bicarbonate, which is going to elevate his sodium levels in the blood. At 4:20, he begins to rapidly decline. So we're talking 15 minutes from the time that they begin the treatment. He rapidly declines and has a seizure within minutes of that. And then they bolus him again at 4:30, right after the seizure, with a hypertonic solution of saline, a 3% concentrated version. So they elevate it even more. So now they're way above and beyond what they should have ever done. And within that first hour, or within 57 minutes, they had increased his level of sodium by 24 millimoles per liter, which is more than what you should do within a 20 or a 48-hour period. They had achieved it in 57 minutes.
Yes, yes. I think the press coverage changed significantly, because it was only a few days ago where CBC was focusing on what, you know, when you read it, sounds like, an abused or a neglected child coming to the hospital. But in an article in the Calgary Herald, they had a witness, and you can tell me who this witness was, admitting that this rapid increase in sodium could have caused death. So who was that first witness who said that?
The doctors, the attending doctors at Alberta Children's Hospital weren't willing to admit it. I'm going to presume that that was probably
They said it was the medical examiner, and
I was going to say the current chief medical examiner of Alberta, right, who actually did the autopsy report, she was pretty admissive on many of those areas where she wasn't, she wasn't extremely defensive, except for the fact that she said that she never looked into that as the cause of death, because that's not her area of expertise, because the last living patient that she had ever dealt with was in 2001. And then the lawyer asked, well, do people die from this condition? And she said, yes. So showing that she should have known how to identify it as a causation of death, being that she is a medical examiner. And so, but that was her way out of it. For claiming why she never looked into it was because it wasn't her area of expertise, but she did admit that that could have, in fact, been the cause of death.
I mean, it does seem important that she would admit that. And then you said the former medical examiner came in and was even stronger.
Was extremely strong on the matter. She said absolutely that it was the cause of death. There was two causes of death she identified, and one was a bit of a surprise, because it wasn't even covered throughout the trial. And what it was, or so we have the over-rapid saline correction as the first causation of death, but the second additional causation of death was just the sheer amount of fluids that little John Wyatt Clark was given, wherein it was identified that within the first hour of him being in Alberta Children's Hospital, they had increased his fluid levels by over 100%. Now, she gave clarity to this, saying that if you were to increase or dilute the blood by 20%, you're going to expect some really bad symptoms from it. You're not going to be in a good situation. You increase the level of fluid by 40%, you're going to exhibit major symptoms and likely die from it. She said if you increase over 100%, it's basically guaranteed death at that point. So really, you've got two clear pictures here, two treatments, or they're all one and the same treatment, being fluid with the saline, but you have two factors here that either one of them by themselves would basically be a death sentence in the average person.
What was also interesting about this case, to change gears a little bit, was that there appeared to be a very rapid decision that the parents were at fault. How long was it? John Wyatt Clark died within 21 hours of arriving at the hospital. How long was it before the parents faced charges?
Well, the charges, my understanding...
Or faced the police, you know, not necessarily charges, but were...
Much better question there. Yes, it gives a better picture. It was within hours. So what took place is shortly after this major, I'll talk medically here, this major insult to him, to his body, taking place at about 4:20 p.m. on November 28th. Shortly after that, there appeared to be a shift in regard to, one, the way that he was being treated. They began to treat him as if he had an infection, whereas prior to that, they weren't treating him for an infection. And two, that's when CFS, I guess is the proper name here, Child and Family Services got involved, and then CPS, being Calgary Police Service, got involved that very evening.
What do you mean? So they arrived at around 3-something p.m., and you're saying that same evening, so within like 6 hour, 8 hours of arrival?
Yeah, there was already activity taking place. Yeah. Or at least they were notified of it. The doctor notified them of it. Because what happened is right after this took place, the major injury to him is that the doctors went into blaming them, claiming negligence and saying, and Child and Family Services get involved. It's the same thing they did to us. So I understand the routine. And then, yeah, so by the time the next morning rolls around, and in mid-morning, he ends up having a cardiac arrest, which is the second cardiac arrest that he had, which you would anticipate being that his body or his brain is able to control, regulate anything. He ends up dying, and as soon as he dies, the parents are apprehended by the police, and the other two children are taken into custody of Child and Family Services.
So I guess the point I'm making is that it was extremely rapid. It's not like, you know, the doctors were focusing on, we got to save this life, we didn't manage to do it, the child died, now we need to investigate, and then maybe 2-3 weeks later, you decide that, you know, it was the parents' fault and you arrest them. This was extremely rapid. And given, you know, what the doctors were doing and trying to focus on the child, that seems like it was an almost instantaneous decision. Another thing that kind of goes to say there might be some bias going on in terms of trying to defend a decision that they made quite rapidly is that the testimony stated on the stand didn't really match what was documented 5 years ago. For example, a doctor, Pingwei Chen, said that the boy was critically ill on arrival at Foothills, had a subdued reaction to needles. Dr. Kathy Ross stated that the baby was moribund on arrival at the Alberta Children's Hospital. And yet what you're saying is that the written evidence of what was documented at the time is quite different.
Absolutely. And in fact, it was interesting because I could share my opinion, but rather than sharing my opinion, I'll share that my opinion coincides with the cross-examination that took place of Annie Savageau today, the former chief medical examiner of Alberta, where those exact questions were posed to her about the testimony from these doctors that currently took the stand. And she reiterated the same thing, is that, you know, that's great that they can say this today, 5 years later, but we have to go by what's actually documented on black and white from 5 years ago. And that, and what we have for documentation does not communicate what they're claiming today.
Right. I mean, it's not proof that they're trying to defend a hasty decision. But if they were trying to defend a hasty decision, then they would probably change their testimony to match that. There could be other reasons. I mean, it could just be that, you know, over 5 years, they kind of forgot the situation, and trying to reconstruct it, they made mistakes. Another thing about the parents is that they are different than, say, the average Canadian parent. They were vegans, Seventh-day Adventists, opposed to vaccines. They had a home birth. They homeschooled their children. Those are all non-mainstream ideas, and some people, you know, consider them a bit wacky, right? Most people get vaccines, and they think that people don't get vaccines are crazy. Most people aren't vegans. Most people aren't terribly religious. So did those things, do you think, have an impact on how the parents were handled? And maybe echoes with your case as well.
Absolutely. I would say that there's quite likely some profiling that took place there, because there's children that die every day, and there's children that die from, you know, mild to major neglect every day. And Alberta mm-hmm. Children's Hospital is going to see those cases a lot of the time if the child doesn't die prior to arriving there. And so it's interesting to note that those that are being charged and making major headlines within Alberta here, having cases that are being derived out of the Alberta Children's Hospital, there seems to be a growing trend. And what it is you know, that tendency towards favoring natural medicine, non-immunizing parents. And it's interesting to note as well, even in the medical files, that is emphasized, even in this case where, you know, the very first doctor makes documentation of it that in big, you know, non-immunized. And so there seems to be at least an identification of these different issues. And mm-hmm. so whether or not it's just an unlikely trend or a coincidental trend that's emerging, or it's with intent, the fact of the matter is that there does seem to be this trend that's reoccurring, wherein Alberta Children's Hospital is inciting action against parents that are living alternative lifestyles in the sense of, you know, non-immunizing, you know, home birthing, whatever, just going against mainstream ideology.
Right, not handing over every health decision to the doctors. Maybe the vaccines are the most important of those. Was there an attempt to say that none of this would have happened if the child had been vaccinated?
Absolutely, yeah. And so I'll preamble that actually with what we saw in our case, and it'll identify the agenda that the Crown is attempting to move forward with here. So in 2014, when we had our preliminary trial, when I say our, I think myself and my wife's preliminary trial in regard to the death of our own son, what was identified is that the Crown was looking to set a precedent in law with our case that would hold parents criminally liable if they didn't vaccinate their children and something happened to the child that was deemed to be vaccine preventable. So what they were attempting to do was classify vaccines as a necessary of life. And so by failing to provide the vaccine, you're failing to provide the necessary of life, which is an indictable offense up to 5 years. So it was interesting going into this case, because what the claim was is that the official causation of death was an overwhelming staphylococcal aureus infection that was complicated by malnutrition. Now, there is no vaccine for staphylococcal aureus. And so mm-hmm. I didn't think that the vaccines were going to come up at all during this trial, except right. for the sake of character assassination before the jury. And sure right. enough, you know, there were some pokes at it in regard to that, you know, talking about their lifestyle, about the fact right. that they'd never been to a doctor and whatnot. But what really surprised me is when they got Dr. Bujabi up there, who is an expert in infectious disease, then the in-depth discussion came out about vaccines, about the various schedule and all that, and the question was posed in regard to the validity of vaccines being a part of this case as to whether or not, if John Wyatt Clark had been immunized, whether or not that would have assisted him in being able to fight off infectious disease. And it was interesting because I was expecting, like what we saw in our preliminary trial, where the doctors would just volunteer their beliefs that without any scientific backing, saying, oh yeah, sure, of course it would, right? Because that's what we were seeing in our case. I was assuming that that's what was going to come out of Dr. Bujabi's mouth, but in fact it was the opposite. He said, in this case, it would have no impact. Mm-hmm. And he said, you need to understand that this is a staphylococcus aureus infection and that there is no vaccine for it. Well, we didn't hear a thing about vaccines after that point.
Okay.
It shut that part of the case right down.
Speaking of the infectious theory, what were the results of any cultures or other tests for bacteria or viruses that were done?
Great question. So actually, if you want me to break down mm-hmm. The listed causations of death being staphylococcus aureus, overwhelming staphylococcus aureus with complicated by malnutrition, I can do so right now. So what happened is, upon arrival to the Alberta Children's Hospital, it was, you know, they were trying to, it was a presumed infection that they were working with based on the, on some of the symptoms, but he didn't have the symptoms of inflammation that would accompany stage two or stage three sepsis. So there wasn't the inflammatory markers. Mm-hmm. And so he didn't have the appearance of having septic shock. And mm-hmm. so what they did, though, to try to rule it out is they went to take a blood culture at 4 o'clock. So even right. before they did anything to his blood, diluted it or anything, they did this blood culture, and they also checked for vitamin levels and all that within the blood. And what they found is after 5 days that 4 o'clock blood culture didn't grow anything.
So now, it was negative for everything.
Negative, and all of the nutrient levels were proper. They were fine. So he wasn't malnourished according to the first blood test. Now, they took a 5 o'clock rating.
Okay, now, just run that past me again. He was not malnourished. They couldn't find any malnourishment, any low vitamin levels.
That's correct. Off the 4 o'clock, the purest right. blood sample that they can get, just arrived to the hospital, it's going to be the best indicator to his right. condition upon arrival. Mm-hmm. So all of his vitamin levels are normal, and there's no infectious agent. Mm-hmm. Now, they're claiming it's an overwhelming staph infection. There must be overwhelming evidence to support that.
You couldn't and miss yet, it, right?
That's right. And so, but it, nothing showed up. So what happens is at 5 o'clock, by the time that they had diluted his blood basically right in half by increasing the volume of fluids mm-hmm. in his body by over 100%, they take another blood culture. And what they discovered from that one is that after being in the hospital setting for nearly 2 hours, is that it grows a staphylococcus aureus, which is well known to be within the hospital setting. So, it could have been due to contamination. In fact, Dr. Brooks Lim, the chief medical examiner of Alberta currently, actually admitted to that it could have very well been due to contamination and that it actually wasn't an infectious agent residing in his
body. What do you mean? But contamination of what?
Contamination of needles, contamination okay. of the skin. It could have come from multiple sources mm-hmm. From within the hospital, and that it was identified as being scant, which means meager or unsubstantive or little. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting because we're seeing it's an overwhelming staph infection, yet all that they have is scant bacteria of this Staphylococcus aureus. And so it doesn't make sense, you know, that they would use that and solely hang their hat off of that. So as the staph infection or right. the infectious agent that he had. Now, what they do as well is they test the 5 o'clock blood, which has been largely diluted, and he's also destabilized because his brain's just basically been fried by all of this saline. They test that for nutrients, and what they find, obviously, is what you would anticipate to find in diluted blood. Diluted no. levels of vitamins. And so then they say, oh, he's got malnourishment. And so this is what's going on. They hang their hats on that. But what happens is after he passes, 3 days later, Dr. Brooks Lim gets a chance to perform an autopsy on him, takes feces, cerebral spinal fluid, and blood, and goes and has it cultured. And it brings back no results. Now, remember, at this point, he'd only been on antibiotics for less than 20 hours. Because he started at about 4:30 or 4:26 p.m. on November 28th, and he dies, and he's pulled off life support at just after noon on November 29th. So just over 20 hours of antibiotics, and
right.
Yet there's no trace of any infectious agent. So what they're solely hanging their hat off of is a quite
the 5 p.m.
the 5 p.m. that's quite step. Possibly contaminated. And so what Dr. Annie Savageau said today is that there's no scientific basis to say that he had a staph infection. He didn't have the symptoms of it, mm-hmm. and there is nothing to substantiate it, even based off of the scientific methods that he performed.
Right. Did they do any nutrition testing on the postmortem samples?
Yes, they sure did. So what Dr. Brooks Lim did is she pulled blood from little John Wyatt Clark after he'd been dead for 3 days. She pulls out blood samples and has them tested. And what she finds from it is that the vitamin D levels were very low, vitamin A was low, and that they couldn't get a zinc rating because the blood had degraded so much. And so this is what they were hanging their hats on in regard to that. And so what Dr. Annie Savageau presented today was two different studies where they took children who had died and they tested their blood postmortem for vitamin D. Now, none of these children had died with malnourishment. So right. they died, you know, other causes of death, but malnourishment was not a cause. So what they identified, though, is out of, you know, 40 test subjects, that only 10 of those test subjects actually came back with a normal rating of vitamin D after the postmortem blood had been taken. So what they identified from that is that it's not an accurate reading that you will get from postmortem blood. And actually, Dr. Brooks Lim conceded that that was, in fact, the case as well, saying that it's not the best thing to rely on.
Well, it might make some sense if that's all they had, but they have these 4 p.m. samples, which were negative for an infectious agent and were negative for malnutrition.
Exactly.
Those seem like the best samples to work with.
So then the question has to be asked then, well, what did John Wyatt Clark come in with? Well, what was causing the necrosis of his toes if it wasn't an infectious agent, which, by the way, would have been producing a really foul odor if he had necrosis of the toes due to infection? And that's well known. And there was nobody that commented or made notes that he was producing a foul odor. Whereas if it's oxygen deprivation to the toes, it won't produce a foul odor. And so it's quite likely that it was due to oxygen deprivation. And what was identified is that in a CT scan that Dr. Brooks Lim had access to and was made aware that it was identified that there was a thrombus in the inferior vena cava.
And a thrombus is?
A thrombus is a fibrous clot.
Okay.
That creates the condition of thrombosis.
And where was it?
It was in the inferior vena cava, which is the main vein that brings all the blood back up from the legs to the heart.
Okay, and so obviously something like that would cause a major decline in the amount of blood circulating, and obviously that could cause these problems. Of course,
exactly.
That's probably pretty unusual in a young child, but I'm sure it's not unheard of.
Well, whether it's unusual or not in the child, the fact that it was actually identified that there was a thrombus, whether it's unusual for a child to have a thrombus, John Wyatt Clark did have a thrombus, one, and they never, ever searched to see if he had any more in his lower leg veins to identify if that was in fact the case. But it was on their radar. Thrombosis was considered as one of the causes of the blackening of the toes. Even before John Wyatt Clark was dead, the attending physicians in Alberta Children's Hospital were made aware of thrombosis being a likely cause of it, and yet they never substantiated it, and they never ruled it out. So if I go back to my own experience, when they end up in cover-up mode, they avoid any of the real causations that would hang them out to dry. And what they do is they look for to substantiate a different cause of death that will hold the parents liable and cover their own backside. And so that's what we saw in our own case. So this appears to be the case with this as well, that it was considered, it was made note of, but then they avoided going there altogether because it wouldn't fit the narrative of John Wyatt Clark coming in with this incredible infection that they couldn't possibly save him from.
And I wonder, I mean, we'll never know this, but, you know, if the doctors were aware, well, you said the doctors were aware right from the beginning that this was a non-vaccinating family that had other, you know, non-mainstream views about health, would they treat it differently? Would they assume that this had to be a case of a malnourished child or something like that? And whereas what if it had been the child of a doctor or something like that, where they would assume, okay, well, child's up to date on all the vaccines, the child's well-nourished, et cetera, et cetera. They might have looked at it differently, but that's just speculation. We cannot really know that.
We'll have to wait a few years, and maybe we'll have another conversation 10 years down the road and see if any trends have been galvanized coming out of Alberta Children's Hospital. But you're quite likely bang on in that that they're, you know, if this child had been immunized, if the child, you know, came from parents that were living a normal lifestyle, there likely wouldn't be any proceedings before the courts today.
Yes. Even if the child had died, they would have said, well, it's just one of those unfortunate things that happens even to the children of the best parents. Let's talk a little bit about your case, because there's a lot of parallels here. Last time we talked, you were appealing your case. So why don't you start us there? You were convicted, as I said at the beginning, of not a failing to provide the necessities of life, and you appealed that. So then what happened?
Absolutely, yeah. So we noticed there was a, well, we knew there was a major issue in regard to the jury or the judge's instruction to the jury. Many people in Canada think that things can't go wrong in a court case, especially when you have a jury. If a jury rules one way or the other, it has to be the gospel truth. And that was what we actually went into court thinking. And that's why we chose to have a jury. But what we found is that when you have the jury who are the judges of the facts, and you have the judge who is the judge of the law and what facts go before the jury, you've got this judge playing the role of a gatekeeper and getting the, you know, basically instructing the jury on how to rule. And what we found is that the judge erred substantially in law. And it was identified by our lawyer, and it was a point that was brought up for probably about 3 hours of conversation with the judge on how he was going against case law, but he still went ahead with it. And so what happened is we were convicted, and 6 out of the 12 jury members were crying when they gave the verdict, and anybody who was watching this said they didn't want to give that verdict. So if we fast forward a year later, we're now in the appeals court, and there's a panel of 3 judges in Calgary, Alberta, here at the appeals court. And one of the judges takes major issue with the charge that the judge gave the jury. And he said, based on that error in law, the jury had no choice but to find this couple guilty. And so he was willing to take a firm stand. 8 months later, we finally get our decision, which is extremely long, long time for appeal court to decide. And it's a 2-1 decision against us, which was a surprise because we thought it'd be a 2-1 decision for us,
right,
being that one of the other judges coincided with him and actually cited case law as to how the first judge had erred in law. And so having that dissenting judge allowed us to go to the Supreme Court of Canada, because they don't just accept any case. There's got to be some really good grounds for going forward. And one of those grounds is having a dissenting judge in one of the lower courts. And so we ended up at the Supreme Court May 15th of 2018. And, you know, it's a pretty short process, half an hour for the defense, half an hour for the Crown, a little bit of discussion surrounding the elements of law. And then generally, the Supreme Court justices, whether it be 5 or 7 or 9, will go back and deliberate and come out, or they will postpone the decision. And generally, it's postponing the decision. Now, in our case, there were 7 justices, and so they went back. They came out about 10, 15 minutes later, and they ruled unanimously in our favor, identifying that there was a major error in law of that first judge that created that wrongful conviction. And so now that they've done that, we're back at square one again, as if we'd never been through the court process except for the financial burden of about $1 million going through those
small
processes.
Issue. And,
yes. And so now that we're depleted, you know, our resources are completely depleted, and we've liquidated just about anything of substantial value to pay for the first trials. Now we're back at square one with you know, empty pockets, and we got to go forward again. But the beautiful thing about it is that we have a lot more evidence that was withheld from the first trial, and it's going to be a completely different trial this time around because it looks like we understand the real cause of death in regard to the passing of our son compared to when we went into the other trial. We thought maybe he did die from bacterial meningitis. Maybe it's a really extremely atypical case, you know, because of the nutrient levels right. that he had or something like that. And maybe that's why he didn't show the symptoms of bacterial meningitis. But this time around, we have a much better footing on what's going on and the cover-up that took place.
And by evidence that you didn't have before, you're talking about medical evidence, medical records?
Yes, yes. So what we've identified is that there appears to be destroyed evidence that we can't get our hands on in regard to his initial treatment, which would give a clear picture as to what actually took place and why he died in the hands of the medical system. And we've also got withheld evidence because when the police did an investigation, what's supposed to happen is they're supposed to turn over all of the evidence that they get. Now, interestingly, though, the police somehow knew what files specifically to request from the medical system, from Alberta Health Services, that would omit other evidence that told a different story about what he died from. So when we went and did our own request, we ended up with about 173 more pages of medical evidence that tells a different story that goes in direct contravention of the falsified autopsy report surrounding the death of our son.
That's all pretty depressing to think that the system would be everybody pushing for a conviction. But I know in cases like, what was it, the pathologist in Ontario named Charles Smith, and there's been similar pathologists in the United States and the United Kingdom, that, you know, they knew the pathologist would come up with evidence to try to convict the parents or the caregiver, and it wasn't always the parents. And, you know, after he was basically discredited, then they had a whole bunch of cases that had to be re-examined. And also the Toronto Sick Children's Hospital had a program called Mother Risk that did things like hair testing, which is now being completely invalidated, and everybody who lost their children. And that is one of the tragedies. I mean, I guess you kept your other children, but in the case of the Clarks, they lost their two children, right?
That's correct. They were taken out of their custody, and it's been now 5 years. It was a 3-year-old son and a 7-year-old son, so a 3-year-old son doesn't even really know who his parents are, to my understanding. And so, yeah, that's the sad thing about it, and it's the children that really suffer the most. In fact, when you break it down right to the nuts and bolts of what the Crown is attempting to do, if you just take a look at what's taking place, and let's say hypothetically that the Clark were everything that the Crown said they were, that they were negligent and all that, but yet they're loving parents.
Mm-hmm.
The very loss of their son would be the greatest learning lesson that they would ever have in their right. life. It would be the greatest punishment that they could ever receive. And any jail time or any other action that from then on out would only be increased suffering to the children. And so yes. the same thing goes in our case. Let's just say hypothetically that the Crown was completely correct in their theory about us and our treatment of Ezekiel. Well, by them pursuing action, all they're doing is putting our four other kids in harm's way.
Well, I think I think what they would say is, well, you know, if you or the Clarks are incompetent, uncaring parents, then obviously the other children are at risk. But in both cases, you had a family, I think the Clarks had, well, you said they had two other children. All the other children were healthy, which doesn't support the notion that the parents are somehow competent or, you know, starving their child. You have to come
That's
up with
right.
some reason, like why one child has been selected for this punishment when the other children all seem normal and healthy.
Exactly, and the police raid where they went and took pictures of their house, what they found was prenatal vitamins, children's liquid multivitamins, a bunch of different supplements. They found organic food, fresh fruits and veggies, and they found numerous books they took pictures of that were on nutrition and health. And so it just seemed really interesting that you've got this family that seems to be quite proactive, and yet one of their children would be neglected and malnourished. It just doesn't make sense. I mean, the scientific evidence doesn't back it up, and the observational evidence doesn't back it up either.
Yeah, and I brought up another example when we were talking earlier. There's lots of people who either feed their children a horrible Western diet, you know, hamburgers, hot dogs, French fries, lots of sugary drinks, all that kind of stuff. And a lot of children are coming down with diabetes, which we know can be stimulated by a high carbohydrate diet. And diabetes can be fatal, and yet I've never heard of a parent with a diabetic child being investigated to see whether it was the parent's fault the child became diabetic, and if the child died, then charge the parents with something. That never seems to occur to the doctors.
Exactly. There's a major double standard. I mean, if I were to identify one double standard, because I've had a lot of people share these other cases of children dying from meningitis in the hospital setting because it was overlooked or whatnot, but you know, and that's, you know, it's horrific that that's happening, and that illustrates a double standard because the doctors aren't being held accountable. But right within our own case, there's a double standard because what happened is when Alberta Health Services took over the ambulance services in the Southern Alberta region, there was a certain region where the ambulances were proactively destocked of that infant equipment necessary to ensure that the paramedics can airway for a child that was in need of an airway. And so the paramedics had made note of that and had made multiple requests over the period of a year for that equipment, and it fell on deaf ears. And so when my son ended up in this ambulance that didn't have the proper equipment and went over 8 minutes without any oxygen whatsoever in that ambulance, that constitutes criminal negligence resulting in death.
And so
it's interesting that right contained in our own case, you've got this double standard of, well, here's this major crime that's liable for up to 25 years in jail, but we're not going to do anything with that. In fact, we're not even going to so much as investigate it, even though now that ambulance, a week after the passing of Ezekiel, finally now has that equipment in it. It took the passing of my son to do that, but yet we're going to turn our crosshairs onto these parents, and we're going to change the narrative and go against scientific practices in creating a whole new causation of death that would hold the parents liable and not the medical system.
We've come to the end of our hour. It's been a fascinating conversation and sometimes disturbing to think of some of the ramifications of what has been going on. I would just like to thank you for your commitment to covering this story. I feel like you're the journalist, and I'm just taking advantage of this huge amount of effort you've put into bringing out all of this information. And we'll definitely need to get an update when this is over, hopefully fairly soon. I don't want to take sides, but it seems to me that the evidence is that it was not the parents' fault in this case, and they should be found innocent.
Overwhelmingly, even if the parents hadn't called any evidence, including Dr. Annie Savageau, the former chief medical examiner of Alberta, the evidence before the jury was that none of the previous doctors had reliable testimony in regard to the actual causation of death. It looks overwhelmingly that this is going to be a case where then they're found not guilty, as long as that jury charge is made appropriately by the judge. I'm assuming that it's going to be a not guilty. If I were a betting man, that's where I'd be putting my money. And so it'll be interesting to see where it goes, and I'll keep everybody posted as we move along.
Yeah, well, thank you for doing that, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much, David. Appreciate you having me on.
Okay, good night.
Good night.
Thank you for listening to episode 197 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. If you'd like to support the show, commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.